Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you listening. This morning, we will be talking with a leading researcher in the field of cognitive science. His name is Douglas Hofstadter. He spent quite a few years now working on computer models of human thinking, trying to understand how the mind works and where creativity comes from. He's particularly interested in analogies and the role that they play in human thinking, and he will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois, here in Urbana-Champaign, a little bit later this week to give a talk in the MillerCom series, the title Analogy as the Core of Cognition. That will be Thursday night, 7:30, in the Theater of Lincoln Hall on Wright Street in Urbana. And as is always the case with these programs, they're free and open to the public, and anyone who would like to attend is welcome to stop by. For those who can't, he was good enough to give us some of his time this morning to talk about some of these ideas and in a sense, to preview the talk for Thursday. Doug Hofstadter is professor of cognitive science at Indiana University, where he also directs the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition. He's a graduate of Stanford. He got his undergraduate degree in math there in 65 and also has a PhD in solid-state physics from University of Oregon. And I think probably a lot of people will know him primarily for his first book, Gödel, Escher, Bach, An Eternal Golden Braid, a book which won the 1980 Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction. He has written others, including The Mind's Eye, and one that is an overview of the work that they have done there at Indiana, a book titled Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies. As we talk this morning with Douglas Hofstadter, certainly people who are listening should feel welcome to be a part of the conversation. All you have to do is pick up the telephone and dial the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that means if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving along and get in as many different people as possible, but anyone's welcome to call. Professor Hofstadter, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
I'm happy to do so.
I appreciate it. I think probably for the benefit of people who don't really know what cognitive science is, it might be a good place to start if I'd ask you just to talk in generally, very generally, about the aims of the field.
Okay. Well, cognitive science, its name sort of means the science of thinking. And you could ask, well, how is that any different from psychology? And I would say, well, it overlaps a great deal with psychology. In fact, I wouldn't be upset personally if they renamed it or psychology completely appropriated it. But the reason that hasn't happened is that that over the 20th century, psychologists developed certain standard ways of doing things, certain kinds of experimentation techniques and so forth. And then in the last 30, 40 years of the 20th century, people outside of psychology also started thinking about the mind pretty intensely, but in different fashions, such as computer scientists started trying to make computer models, and of course neurologists exploring the brain were doing things with the hardware, if you wish, cells and so forth, of the brain, and people in education were thinking about it, anthropology, linguistics, so that what it amounted to was kind of a halo around psychology. You could think of it as the metropolitan area of psychology. And in that sense, psychology could be the core of it, but there is this halo, this corona around it. And I think that cognitive science is simply an extended, more general effort that uses methods not traditionally associated with what psychologists have done. But it's really asking the same questions. What is thinking? What is consciousness? How do we remember things? How do we speak? What makes sentences pop out of our mind? What makes us find the right word at the right time? How can we be creative? I mean, all those kinds of questions. Mm-hmm. Those are what I think cognitive science is, at least to me.
What I think makes this field interesting and perhaps also challenging and sometimes difficult is that while we now have technologies that enable us to watch the brain at work, we can scan it and we can ask people to do various things and then we could see what happens. It seems that though what you're talking about here is not really something that you can see, that at least not, you can't look at someone's brain and ask them to think about something and really understand what is going on.
Yes, I agree with you there. I will first of all plead the fact that I'm not terribly knowledgeable about things like fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imagery, and so forth. I've heard talks about them and I've read certain things about them. But my general impression, even though I am an outsider, so I could be wrong, is that they give you information that's far too crude to really. It would be like, trying to understand a novel by lighting up certain words and having certain pages of the novel sort of flash at you. But it doesn't really teach you anything about what the novel is about or what the characters are about or anything like that. It's very, very crude. And I agree with you that the kinds of things that that cognition is about are probably far too subtle for right now, anyway, today's technology to touch. Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, your background, your undergraduate education was in math, and then you went on to grad school and you got this PhD in physics. Mm-hmm. How is it that you, and I know that you'd studied particle physics?
Well, I did particle physics for several years, and then I struck out. Three strikes, and you're out.
What?
Literally, three. I had three advisors in particle physics, and I was out.
They said, "Son, you're never going to amount to anything in this business." and so I guess I'm interested. You know, given the fact that you had this background for studying math and then studying physics, how it is that you became interested in thinking and in, I'm not sure how you feel about the word, the term artificial intelligence, but some people will mean something to some people. So how did you become interested in this area?
Yeah, well, it went back to before my college days. In fact, a friend of mine taught me to program a computer when we were both 15 years old. This was, I can reveal, it was in 1960. And there was only one computer on the entire Stanford campus, and it was in the basement of a building that almost nobody ever went to anymore. It was really an obscure place, but that meant that basically we high school kids were actually given the opportunity to program, and I learned to program, and one of the things that I did was I started to study how words could be arranged in patterns to produce fresh new sentences using random numbers in a certain way, and I had the computer after a short while turning out sentences of all sorts using a rather complicated and novel grammar that I had invented for English, and then I actually applied it to other languages as well, but the point was just simply that it was churning out sentences, many of which sounded silly, but many of which also sounded pretty reasonable. And that started me to think about the question, not only that, but actually I did some research in mathematics using the computer, and I always was looking at the flashing lights on the console. Today they don't have such things, of course, but back then they had flashing lights, hundreds of them on the console. They don't have even consoles anymore, as far as I know, but you know, there I was, a 15, 16-year-old kid watching these lights flashing, and I was thinking, this thing is thinking about about the stuff that I wrote it and told it to do. It's thinking about it. So I was provoked to wonder if thinking, you know, was going on inside this machine. And then when it was exploring mathematics at my request or behest. And then when it was producing funny or unfunny sentences at my behest, It even seemed more like thinking because it was sort of quote saying things unquote to me in a sense, and again I wondered to myself, is this thing thinking? Is it doing anything like what I do when I say things? And so this, when I was 15, 16, 17, and so forth, that is where I began being fascinated, and I thought about this for several years. Then I had a diversion, if you wish. I went on to graduate school in physics, and I kind of didn't think about these things for a while. But when I had my three strikes, you're out experience, and I was desperately searching for what I might be better at than particle physics, of course, I had never forgotten how intensely interested I was in these things. And I thought, maybe, you know, those things I was thinking about are really what I ought to do. And so I went back to stuff I had done some 10 years earlier, and that's basically what happened. Mm.
We have a caller, and I want to bring them in rather than make them wait. We'll ask some other questions, too, and, of course, we'll continue to talk with our guest, Douglas Hofstetter. He's director of the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition at Indiana University, and he will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois a little bit later this week on Thursday to give a talk in the MillerCom series. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Champaign to start us off, line one. Right here. Hello.
Hello. This is Charles.
Yes.
Good morning.
Hi. Go ahead.
Hi. Actually, I have a question that deals with an analogy and relates to both imagery, visual imagery, Persian carpets, and 911, because the professor did mention analogies. So here is my question, and bear with me. The Quran forbids images of human beings, which is why we have Persian carpets, etc., whereas many of the other religions are allowing images of human beings. I believe that this is part of the problem of 911 and deals with the analogy of children using stick figures to create analogies and empathy in the world. My feeling is that perhaps part of the problem with 911 and the lack of Islamic empathy for the people that died has to do with processing or a lack of processing cognition and empathy from the inability to express that by drawing small stick figures as children are growing up. If you look at the madrasas in Pakistan, you will note that there are no images in the Quran. There are no images of people on Persian carpets or Oriental carpets, and it is my feeling that this lack of imagery is in direct contrast to many other religions where images of human beings help build empathy and thereby reduce people essentially shooting each other. So I'm sorry that was a little bit long, but if you have any comments on this in terms of human analogies, I really would appreciate it. And thank you very much.
All right. Well, Professor Hofstetter, I never know what people are going to say. So
that was at least it was a clear question, and I can understand where Charles is coming from in his ideas. I would say that, you know, of course, I'm not deeply knowledgeable about Islam, but the people, the Muslims who I've known personally, have been very compassionate, empathetic people, and I've known quite a few over the years and in different places. And what I know also is I've read books translated from Arabic that tell wonderful stories, wonderful humorous stories, and great novels, great short stories, just as great, just as deep a literature as we have. In the Judeo-Christian tradition, and I don't feel that there's any lack of empathy. If it is true, and I've actually heard it denied by a Muslim, if it is true that the Quran forbids images, there must be something to it. But clearly, it's not exactly the truth. Otherwise, this person wouldn't have been so vehement in telling us in a lecture that the Quran allowed such images. In any case, even if it's 100% true that it forbids images, I think that's a very minor thing, because we all grow up surrounded by fellow human beings. We all grow up interacting with them deeply. We tell stories about each other. Nothing forbids telling stories about each other, and perhaps all it means is that their stories are all the richer if they're forbidden visual imagery. I mean, it would suggest, I mean, taking the point, the caller's point to an extreme, it would suggest that if you're blind, you can't be empathetic because you don't see any pictures of people. And I think that's clearly out of the question. So I guess I think that it's an interesting hypothesis, but I would, if I can use this word on 9/11, shoot it down.
Well, I hope that gets at least it's a partial answer to the question.
Mm-hmm.
Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'd like to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about some of the work that you have done, you and your colleagues have done, and about give us a chance to think a little bit about thinking. And as I understand it, just in the most superficial sense, what you're arguing is that thinking, or perhaps what we call creativity, involves people working with stuff they already know, so things that are a product of all of the experience that they have had in their lifetime, stuff that's all stored somehow in our brains. And that's why it is possible that, you know, you could engage in a conversation with someone that you had never met before. They would come up to you and they would ask you something, that a question that you no one had ever asked you before, perhaps something that you'd never really thought about. And that's how it is that maybe after a little bit of time, and maybe it wouldn't take very much time, you can come up with a response to them. And it has to do with your drawing on all of the experiences that you've had to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And that's perhaps how we come to the subject of analogies, this thing that you're so very much interested in. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to thinking about what thinking is and how it works?
Mm-hmm. Well, in my talk on Thursday, what I'm going to begin by saying, and this is sort of the theme song in a nutshell, is that every choice of word that we make when we utter a sentence, every word choice is made by by means of analogies. And I even would say that I use the plural because it's inside our head. There's a kind of a battle going on, of which most of the time we're pretty unaware. We have to remember, though, that the hardware of the brain does consist of some 100 billion neurons, and they're, you can think of them as little agents that are, in some sense, collectively working or battling against each other to try to have things happen. And we don't think of our brains usually as being this seething, chaotic thing like an anthill or anything, but I think that's a pretty good image to keep in mind. And when, I'll just give you one example, it's one that I like, that when some friends of mine were in my house for a few days and we were doing some cleanup work in my study, they would continually refer to my study as my office, even though they knew that I called it my study. And I kind of laughed at this, and eventually I asked them, I said, why are you constantly calling my study my office rather than my study? And at first they didn't really know, but then they said, and I say they because this is a husband and wife, and they were both doing it, and so they kind of thought about it together. And they said, actually when we think about it, it's because we at our house in Boston have on our top floor what we call our study. It's where we work out of. It's where we keep all of our files and our computers, and it's where we spend they have a home business. And they said, we call it our office. It is our office. And so when we come to your house, we just naturally borrow the term. It's unconscious. It's unconscious. And I said, that's interesting, because now that you're making me think about why I call it my study. And I said, I think I understand now why I call it my study. When I grew up, my father on the top floor, I have to say this is also my study is on the top floor. That's part of the analogy. But when I grew up, my father had an office and a study. His office was down on the Stanford campus, and his study was upstairs in our house. And it was where he did certain things. He had lots of books there. He did a lot of work there. He had an old electrical calculator, actually sort of electromechanical calculator, which could be analogous to my computer these days. And I said it must come from the fact that to me there was a clear distinction between a study and an office. The study was sort of in the home, and where the person did a lot of heavy thinking, and the office was on the campus where they might have had office hours and prepared their lectures. And so I guess I was making an analogy too, but I wasn't even aware of it. And then what was even more amusing was that at some point later, on another visit, one of my friends referred to my study as your attic. And of course, they also call their upstairs room where they do their work their attic. And it showed that unconsciously, what was involved in their word choices and my word choices and everyone's word choices at all times is your past and things that you feel are like what you're dealing with at the present time. That's just one example, but it shows how unconscious forces are producing results that on the surface just sort of seem to come from nowhere. Why would I call this a study? Why would they call it an office or an attic? Well, because of analogy. Now, if you take the example of word choice and then just say, well, my gosh, if it happens every time we choose a word, every single moment we choose any word, and, of course, words are just the smallest level of thought. It also happens every time we choose to a larger phrase. It happens every time we basically focus on what we're thinking about. We're withdrawing into the pool of prior experiences and finding the one that we think is somehow the most appropriate, and then we are focusing on that. And that is the making of analogies. And that's, you know, in a very, very, very summarized form, what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're arguing is when we come into a new situation, a novel situation, we encounter something that we've never encountered before. Part of the way that we try to understand where we are is to ask ourselves the question, how is this like something else I've experienced before?
Yeah, and a dog does that when it goes to another house and it sees a different kind of dog door. And at first it might be a little bit scared, but it sees the other dog going in and out, and it says, I have one of those at my house, sort of. Mm-hmm. Sort of says that, and it kind of, so it makes an analogy, and then after it's done this two or three houses, probably it has formed a category of dog door, and maybe when it goes to its fourth or fifth house, it just does it without any problem.
Then just let me ask one further question about, and this has to do with how it is that people think about creativity. And I think that people, when they think about creativity, they somehow have this idea that what is going on here, what the person is producing, whether it is an idea or it is a physical thing, it's somehow that thing that they're producing is something that has never existed before. It's completely new. No one had ever thought about it before. No one had ever done this thing before. And it's totally new. What I think you're arguing is in fact that's really not what's going on at all. I think in fact in a little Q&A you did last year with New Scientist, you said something that I thought was very striking, where you said, in response to their question about creativity, you said, I'm convinced that creativity is the ability to discover things that are in some sense there for anyone to find.
Yeah. Actually, I think you can certainly see that. I mean, just to take an example that pops to mind in this case, because I happen to be reading about these things these days, is Andrew Weil's proof of Fermat's Last Theorem, about 12 years ago, one of the most famous things in mathematics. I mean, any mathematician would say to you, if you asked, did Andrew Wiles invent that proof? They would say, well, he didn't really invent it. He discovered some abstract structures. I mean, he came to understand what is behind the fact that, you know, there's no solutions to a certain equation. He came to see what the structures are that underpin this. And I think that some people will say Wiles was incredibly creative, and I would agree. But I'd say that I when I'm talking about creativity, which is the propensity to create, I replace it by the word, my personal choice, it's just an invented word, but I think it's a good one, discoverativity, which would be the propensity to discover, which really means, in a certain sense, the propensity to see to the essence of situations, to not be deflected by superficial misleading clues or perhaps, non-clues, whatever you want to call them, but anyway, to really see what matters and what doesn't matter, to be able to put your finger on what matters in a situation, and that comes, of course, through experience, but you basically have to say, I've been in situations like this somehow vaguely before, and the cues that I'm picking up on suggest to me that it must be this kind of situation, so I'm going to ignore all sorts of other things that somebody else might focus on, and I'm just going to go for what I think is right here, and that's it. And if you look at somebody like Einstein, that's exactly what he did. He ignored what other people were saying and crying out, and he just focused on what he thought mattered in any of his discoveries, whether it's that light is made of particles, or whether it was special relativity, or whether it was general relativity, or whatever it might be. Einstein was truly gifted at ignoring most of the irrelevant signals that so many other people were distracted by and seeing what mattered. And after he had seen it, everybody could say, yeah, it was there to be seen. It was there. But how come only he saw it?
We are at our midpoint here. Let me very quickly introduce again our guest, and we have some calls I want to get to. They've been patient with us. Our guest is Douglas Hofstadter. He's director of the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition at Indiana University, Bloomington. He's also professor of cognitive science there. He's author of a number of books. The first, Gödel, Escher, Bach, and Eternal Golden Braid, won him the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction in 1980. A lot of people will know him for that book. He's written some others, including one that, if you're interested in this subject we're talking about, looks at some of the work he and his colleagues there have done at Indiana. That's a book titled Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies. That is an overview, which was co-written with his grad students and postdocs, of something like 20 years of work looking at trying to understand creativity, thinking, to simulate this with computer models. He'll be here on the U of I campus on Thursday to talk about this subject, Analogy as the Core of Cognition. It's a talk in the MillerCom series. That's Thursday night, 7:30 in Lincoln Hall in the theater there. That's on Wright Street in Urbana. It's open to the public. All these programs always are. Questions here are welcome, too. We have a number of callers, and again, people will really help us if they can try to be brief in their comments. That way we can get in as many as possible. We'll go first to someone on a cell phone and on line one. Hello.
Hi. I've been interested in artificial intelligence for some time, and have had a lot of discussions with Jordan Pollack and David Waltz and other people who you know. I wanted to make one comment and then ask you a question. You won't be able to have the time to answer all of them. The comment is, first of all, that you're absolutely right about fNMR being extremely crude. Not only is it an extremely crude tool, it's also the only tool that's being used. And it's very dangerous to hang your hat, so to speak, on what one type of tool gives you. So, and then that's basically what's been going on in the last few years. Here's my questions. In number one, how do your views stand up against Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind, and how do they compare to connectivism. And lastly, do you think there's anything to be said about the idea that thought is not a digital, not a discrete quantity, but is an words are escaping you.
Well,
now.
The term usually used is analog.
Yes, analog.
Or continuous.
Okay, and I'd like to know how you feel about all of those things. I know that in my discussions, I've had to basically refuse to use the word mind because people divorce mind from brain, and I've never seen a mind without a brain. Mm-hmm. People have this tendency to divorce the two, and then you're in a whole different game of word semantics. So maybe you could discuss a little bit about what I've asked. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comments about fMRI. Now, as for my connection to how my ideas might compare with Marvin Minsky's Society of Mind, that was a book written some roughly 20 years ago, and it was a very good book, and I think that we are fairly close in our in our thoughts about the mind. I mean, because as I said a little while ago, I can liken the mind to a seething anthill. It's a metaphor, of course, but so is the phrase society of mind. And what Marvin meant by that was that there are a lot of little agents of which we are unaware running around, if you can use that metaphor, inside our cranium. And those little agents are cooperating or fighting, competing with each other, and producing collectively a phenomenon we call thought. So I'm pretty happy with that metaphor. The details we might not totally agree on. But now connectionism is a whole school in let's say artificial intelligence. It also is in psychology, but it's the idea of trying to understand thinking by modeling in some sense on a computer the neurons in the brain, the brain cells, and how they communicate. They send signals to each other and they sort of trigger each other. It's a complex thing. I can't cover it really, I guess, but because it's just too many. There are too many. There are thousands of people who have worked in the area. It was a very, very trendy area. It started in the 80s, although it had predecessors that go way back to the 40s, but it sort of became famous and important and central in the 80s. And I think it has shown that it has certain qualities that are fluid and flexible in some fashion. But high-level thinking of the sort that I've been referring to today doesn't seem to have come out of it whatsoever. And I think it's trying to make a jump that's too big, which is it's trying to model all of thinking, all the way up to, things like whatever we want, creativity and so forth, whether it's a composition of music or writing a novel or coming up with a good scientific idea, using the most elementary units that we are aware of in the brain, not going down below the cell level, but going down to the level of cells themselves. And that's the jump in physiological terms is from, it's a factor of 100 billion. A cell there are 100 billion of them in neurons in the brain, and the number of connections is about maybe 10,000 to 100,000 times larger than that. And we don't have computer models of anything nearly that complicated. And you're not going to be able to make the big jump from neurons to entire thinking beings so easily. I think that there are going to be many intermediate levels involved in the explanation of thought, and that it's rather ambitious, if not hubristic, to think that you can just say, okay, here are some neurons, and so they're going to think. So I'm a bit skeptical, but I think it's made some good contributions, and so that's all. And I think that's as far as I can go in terms of your question.
Well, just not to put too fine a point on this, but one of the questions that I did want to ask did have to do with how far you think we can take the idea of artificial intelligence. And I think some people would argue that it is possible to design computer programs that will do specific tasks and perhaps do them better and faster than people. But it's some jump from that to a computer that can think in the way that human beings do, or that even a further leap would be start talking about consciousness or start talking about awareness. Do you think that it is possible that someday we would be able to build such a thing?
Well, you were saying that consciousness goes way beyond thinking, but I have to disagree there. To me, if something thinks, it is, by God, it is conscious. Mm. If something is really thinking the way you and I think, it is conscious. Those are synonymous to me. Those are identical concepts. So, but anyway, so let me take your question as asking, will a computer or could a computer or device that we produce someday in the future be able genuinely to think the way we do, as fluidly, as flexibly, as creatively, as insightfully, as empathetically as we do? I can't give a definitive answer to that. I when I went into the field many years ago, I would have said with confidence, yes, and I would have said it's a long, 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 long ways into the future. And in recent years, there have been people like Ray Kurzweil and others who have trumpeted the idea that, that you know, basically superhuman intelligence is just around the corner. Kurzweil and a number of other well-known figures in the world of computers have written books like his 1999 book, which was called The Age of Spiritual Machines, and his current book called The Singularity is Near, and other people like Hans Moravec from Carnegie Mellon, a famous roboticist. These people are claiming that in 20 years or so, maybe less, there will be computers that are just as intelligent as us that you can buy for $1,000, and that a few years later, 10 years later, there you can buy $1,000 will buy you the equivalent of 1,000 human minds, and then pretty soon it'll just be like for $1,000 you can buy the entire intelligence of all of humanity all over the entire Earth for $1,000. Well, you know, these are technological predictions that are to my mind, just pretty crazy. But I'm not going to dismiss all of them out of hand at the same time. I find them disturbing, strange, and pretty implausible, because I personally think that thinking is an incredibly subtle thing, whereas they think it's just a question of just getting enough computational power, and by God, it'll think. Mm-hmm. I think that personally it's not like that. But anyway, these people have written long books, and they're not stupid people, and I'm not going to try to dismiss or argue it, argue it against it in a two-minute answer or something. I can't do that. But I'm very skeptical. But at the same time, I would say that I still cling to the original belief that I had when I entered this field a long time ago, that in principle, what computers do is that they manipulate symbols, or if you don't want the word symbols, they manipulate little structures, and that these structures they're patterns. If their patterns are right, they can imitate or sort of mirror the outside world, and basically that's what our brains do. Our brains represent the outside world. We form categories, and we apply our categories to the world, and that's what I mean when I say we make analogies. And there's nothing in principle that says that computers couldn't do that just as well as we can. Of course, so far they haven't, and it's turned out to be terribly hard, and I'm delighted that it's turned out to be terribly hard. For me, it's optimism to say that artificial intelligence is a long, long, long way in the future. To me, it's pessimism to say it's just around the corner. I find it very troubling and disturbing to suggest that we're just about to achieve our own level of intelligence or even surpass it. I find that pessimistic and frightening. But in any case, I have to, if I believe that our brains are physical things and that our minds are just, as the caller said, in some sense, minds don't exist without brains. Basically, minds are what happens when brains represent the world in a very subtle way. Well, then computers could do that in principle someday, and so computers could have minds, and so computers could have thoughts, and they could have selves and consciousness and all the rest.
Our guest, Douglas Hofstadter, he's professor of cognitive science at Indiana University, where he also directs the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition. He'll be here later this week to give a talk in the MillerCom series about analogy as the core of cognition. Thursday night, 7:30. Anyone's welcome to go. We have a number of callers here, and we'll try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains. Next, we'll go to Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Earlier, there was a call that was, I think, tangential to your topic, but it suggested that in Islam, the injunction against human images in art might have desensitized Muslims. And I should like to point out that his reference was to the Persian rug, which rarely does include human motifs, although it does include animal and bird motifs fairly commonly. that the same culture gave rise to the magnificent Persian miniatures, which do include human images. I would also point out that back in the 10th century, when the first Crusaders entered Jerusalem, they massacred the entire population. These were the same people who produced the magnificent medieval tapestries, which include human images, motifs, often humans doing great violence to other humans, but nevertheless human figures. A few years later, when the great Islamic leader Saladin recaptured Jerusalem, not a single Jew or Christian died. I rest my case.
Yeah, I think it's a very good case, and I appreciate it. It agrees completely with my own opinion.
All right, I want to go on to thank the caller, and let's go to Kankakee next, line 4. Hello.
Douglas Hofstadter is one of the formative influences in your caller's thinking. Your caller is impressed that Dr. Hofstadter's mind is that eternal golden braid of which he also has previously written. Your caller is honored to be able to ask Dr. Hofstadter to discuss the relationship between paradox and analogy, or to discuss the paradoxical aspects of analogy. Thank you.
Well, paradox and analogy. I don't know that there's an intimate connection between them, but I would say that often the best thinkers are those people who are attracted by paradoxes. In other words, they see a situation in the world as interesting. They single out. They decide, say a scientist decides to focus on something precisely because there seems to be something paradoxical about it. Again, I come back to Einstein, where there were paradoxes in the way light was behaving. And Einstein focused on these things. Instead of shying away, he focused on the paradoxical things and was attracted by paradoxes. I would say that paradoxes have an attractive quality to certain kinds of minds, and that those minds then, when they use analogies, they have to jump back and forth between, maybe this analogy will help shed light on it or will even explain it. Maybe that one will. And then they kind of try around and explore, and eventually perhaps can explain a paradox, or at least move from one paradox to another paradox, which is often what happens, rather than really explaining it. Those are some thoughts about analogy and paradox that come to mind.
All right. Again, I thank the call. Let's go to Urbana for another caller here, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, you said you took consciousness to be thinking or problem solving, and for the layman, I think most of us think of consciousness as self-awareness in some sense or another, and so I was wondering why that was not a part of your discussion here, but I wanted to piggyback on what the last caller talked about, but I formed my question a little more differently. I'm wondering what do you see as the limits of analogy? Do you think, for example, we could analogy is sufficient for us to have discovered logic, for example, or is logic the fruit of something else? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
All right.
Mm-hmm. About consciousness, I agree with you. Self-awareness is really what consciousness is about. You put words into my mouth when you said that I had said that consciousness was equal to problem solving. I didn't use that word. I kind of studiously avoid that phrase. I don't really like it as a description of what thinking is all about. I don't think that when I am thinking, I'm solving problems most of the time. I mean, I'm just being reminded of things casually, accidentally. A lot of things is just kind of random. There's no, it's not problem solving. So, but the making of categories inside our minds or brains in order to deal with the outside world has the curious effect of allowing us to model ourselves. I mean, we can model, first we model inanimate objects, then we model other people, and pretty soon we find ourselves modeling ourselves, understanding ourselves, applying this machinery of thought to ourselves. And it's when we do that that we build a self model. And when we build a self model that is very intricate and it becomes indispensable in our way of talking about our own actions, that becomes so ingrained and deeply rooted in us that we can't get rid of it. And that is the I, the capital letter I, the pronoun I, meaning myself. That self-model is what it is. And it comes out of the very fluid ability to deal with other creatures and ourselves as if we were another creature. That ability could, in theory, be possessed by I don't like the word computer, but anyway, by some thing that we create, some entity that we create that also models the world in its own way. There's no reason that it couldn't have its own life story, its own history of events that have happened to it, its memory of those events, its often distorted, the way ours are distorted, its simplifications and its little homilies about itself, its self-delusions. That would be its own I, and consciousness is that. That's what it is.
All right. Again, let's try and get one more caller, and this would be someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi there. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you talked briefly about your view on, I guess, basically the strong AI question, and I recently finished the book, The Emperor's New Mind, which references your work a lot, by Roger Penrose, and his conclusion was that we don't understand enough physics to have AI yet. Could you just comment on what your feeling is?
Yeah, I think Roger Penrose is a brilliant mathematician and a very interesting physicist, and I have great respect for him. Just a fascinating person. But I think he went too far in his books. I really don't think the question of what a mind is has much to do with physics. I think it has to do with the organization of our categories or concepts, if you wish. What is a concept? And I don't think that it takes quantum mechanical hardware, which he thinks, in order to have concepts. I think it takes a lot of deep structure. I think it takes a great deal of collective, very small entities, like I said, ants or, if you wish, cells, but whatever. I don't think it has to do particularly with the quantum mechanical substrate. I think it could be modeled just as easily on a classical substrate. And I think Penrose is deluded. But he's an interesting fellow, and he writes well. And so it's good to have somebody like that around making interesting points.
All right. I'm going to try again to squeeze one more. Southern LaSalle County, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I think of my dad. I wish I could really say exactly what he said, but he said something to the point of, you can't say I didn't take you places. And this brings up your thought this morning on conversation about what you call things. This was in the days of the early Pennsylvania Turnpike, and we were outside of Springfield, Massachusetts, and we ran into car trouble, and this little nice little lady, gray-haired, let us in, a family of five, for the night. And she had us in this one bedroom. And when we went in there, she said, which I don't think I've ever heard another person say, she says, "Well, in the morning, I'll show you the glory hole." And mm-hmm. The glory hole turned out to be all her antiques. And she said if she put a door knocker at the door, it would have come back unscrewed. So I just thought maybe the young generation could see the value of travel.
Well, that's fascinating. I think that, yeah, people use words in creative ways, and I think that's a very important point, is that we do use words in creative ways. We don't just use them in a formulaic way. We extend them constantly. We are constantly making words do work that they never did before. Just a simple example is a computer virus, which we all use. But somebody had to invent that. Somebody first thought of that idea and applied the word virus to it. And we do this all the time. We use words in such fluid, creative, inventive ways. That is really what thinking is about. So I appreciate your comment.
Well, I think that we're about the point here we're going to have to finish, and I want to say thanks very much to all of the callers. To mention again that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, that our guest, Douglas Hofstadter, will be giving a talk on the U of I campus about analogy as the core of cognition. This is Thursday night, 7:30, in the Theater of Lincoln Hall. That's on Wright Street in Urbana. And this is part of the MillerCom series. It's also sponsored by the Department of History. And so anybody who is interested in hearing more from the guests should certainly turn out for that. They're always free and open to the public. Our guest, Douglas Hofstadter, is professor of cognitive science at Indiana University, where he also directs the Center for Research on Concepts and Cognition. And by the way, if you're interested in this subject area that we're talking about here today, you might take a look at a book that he has authored, along with some of his colleagues there, a book that came out a number of years ago but is still available. It's available now in the paperback. The book is Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies, Computer Models of the Fundamental Mechanisms of Thought, and it is now available in paperback, and it's published by HarperCollins. So you can go out and look for the book. And Professor Hofstadter, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you, and I thank all the listeners for their interesting questions.